Okay, and now I'll turn it over to Harold. Thank you. Harold, now you got to unmute yourself.
Sorry. This is the National Capital Astronomers. Welcome, everybody. Let me see. Does anybody need to say anything for the good of the order? No doubt.
Jack does.
Jack does. Jack, say something.
Something.
No.
I would like to announce that the American Physical Society Senior Physicist Group will have a virtual talk on Wednesday, May 19 at 1 p.m. The speaker is Charles Adler from St. Mary's College of Maryland, and he will give a talk titled How Science Fiction Becomes Science. There is a link to the abstract and biography, and also a link to the Zoom meeting on page 7 in the calendar events of Stardust. Everyone is welcome. Please come.
I see Sue Bassett is here. They had a really good meeting. I even let my class into because it was relevant to what we were discussing in class. Hi, Sue. And I've rejoined the Astronomical Society of Greenbelt because they can do some great things there that the only person that I've seen that done comparable things is Elizabeth, our excellent host. So when I get moved back into when I get my new planetarium and my new building, I'm looking forward to using some of the people to recommend some software to get a telescope so I can have virtual shows like Elizabeth's has run and like the people at the Astronomical Society of Greenbelt have done. Are there any other announcements that need to be made from our various and sundry people?
Yes, I have an announcement.
Yes,
The National Capital Astronomers are going to award a door prize to the meeting of the International Astronomical Society, right?
Right.
We haven't decided yet what the prize is going to be, but I welcome any recommendations. It's going to be in the $100 to $120 range. Please let me know what you think. Thank you.
We certainly have plenty of money.
Yeah.
In part because so many people have donated telescopes that we have sold.
Exactly. We've got plenty of those. So whatever the door prize is for the National Astronomical Society, please let me know. Thank you.
Of course, next month we'll have science fair winners.
Might be of interest to people in the club. There is a biography of Vera Rubin that came out, I think, just in February of this year. And I just ordered it today, so I haven't read it. But that should probably be of interest to the members.
No.
Thank you, Sue.
Do you remember who wrote it?
I don't recall the name of the author. But it's entitled Vera Rubin, A Life, so you can easily find it. And next month, I'll give you a review of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Sue. We actually had hail at my house today. You know, ice falling from the sky, as well as some rain.
Me too.
Better ice than Chinese rockets.
Yeah, that's true. Well, now maybe it's time for...
be careful what you wish for.
John to introduce our speaker.
Yes, it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Jill Helmbold, our speaker for the evening. He's a radio astronomer at the Naval Research Laboratory. His undergraduate work was at Central Michigan University in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. And his graduate work was at New Mexico State University at La Cruces, New Mexico. Very early in his graduate work, he became involved in research on galaxies and started publishing papers on that topic. A couple of years later, he was one of the co-authors on the first release of data from the very widely used Sloan Digital Sky Survey. He continued his research on the extreme types of galaxies that bracket Hubble's sequence of the types of galaxies, namely the spherical limit of the elliptical galaxies and the open pinwheel type of the spiral galaxies. And in 2005, he obtained his PhD in astronomy for a thesis on the formation of stars in those extremely different types of galaxies. He then did postdoctoral work at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And let's see, where am I? Which is conveniently located for work at the Jansky Very Large Array of Radio Telescopes, which is near Socorro, New Mexico. The Jansky Very Large Array mathematically combines the radio signals received by multiple dish antennas spread over a large area to provide the fine angular resolution that would otherwise have required an impossibly large single dish that would have been as large as the entire area spanned by the whole array of galaxies, but of antennas. Let's see.
He then did postdoctoral work.
His work at the Jansky Array included the discovery and analysis of a tight cluster of over a million stars on the outskirts where two galaxies had merged, a system that could explain how globular clusters of stars form in galaxies. He then did further postdoctoral research at NRL using data from a worldwide multi-antenna array to study the kind of supermassive black holes that produce ultra-relativistic jets of radio-emitting material. He also helped to develop arrays of radio telescopes that sought to obtain radio astronomical data at the very informative but difficult and challenging lower radio frequencies. Those frequencies have been called the last frontier of ground-based radio astronomy. He then became a civil servant scientist at NRL in the radio astronomy group, continuing to do work on those two topics. And he's going to tell us about the low frequency work tonight. Joe?
All right, thank you very much, John. And you left out the most important bit, is that when I was at NRL, I met a gentleman named John Hornstein, who was just finishing up his tenure there when I was starting. So it was a great pleasure to meet John, to be with all of you tonight. And we tested this earlier. Hopefully this still works. Sharing my screen. Okay. Laser pointer. Okay. So as John said, I'm my official title at NRL is radio astronomer. I am in a group of radio astronomers there. I once met someone who thought that that meant I was an astronomer on the radio, which sounds more interesting, but it just means that they were doing astronomy primarily at radio frequencies. And I'm going to be talking about what I've become to specialize in over the last 7 or 8 years, which is actually using radio astronomical sources to study Earth's ionosphere, which is the ionized portion of our upper atmosphere, sort of where space begins. And so just a little primer on the part of the radio frequency I'll be talking about. We sort of loose definitions of the term long wavelength or low frequency. We're typically meaning if you're familiar with these terms, the high end of HF or the low end of VHF, sort of 10 to 75 megahertz range. The 10 megahertz range is where below that, the ionosphere starts to essentially block signals. And so there's not much astronomy to be done from the ground. At those frequencies, and then the upper limit of that band is actually kind of arbitrary, but this is the kind of range that we specialize in it in our group at NRL. And there's a little chart down here that shows you about where we're talking about relative to the sort of microwave or say ham radio frequencies. We're sort of just above, you know, talking about overlapping a little bit with kind of ham or CB radio, and then going up to about where the TV band or FM band starts. And what we've focused on at NRL is developing techniques, and talk a bit about this in this talk, about what makes it so challenging to work in this regime. We've developed techniques to get around things like ionospheric turbulence and the impact that has on the observations. And also the fact that the resolution of any telescope is proportional to the wavelength. So as you go to longer wavelengths, you need bigger and bigger things that you just can't build a telescope that's big enough. And so one of the things we've worked on is developing specialized antennas to be used in arrays like this one, which is called a long wavelength array. And these are sort of bow tie shaped antennas that are meant to work in the 10 to 80 megahertz range. And to use these together to image the sky or particular sources in detail in the sky. And you know, if you could look up the sky and look at these long radio wavelengths, instead of an empty darkness, you would actually see something sort of like this, which is a sky that's almost filled with emission, especially from our own galaxy, because there are relativistic electrons throughout our galaxy giving off synchrotron radiation, and that spectrum keeps getting brighter as you go to lower frequency. And then there are individual sources, like there's a supernova remnant here that's very bright, the remnant of the last supernova to go off in our galaxy. And only Jupiter will be very bright and give off bursts of emission as well. And then if you see something like this near the horizon, this is the bane of the low frequency radio astronomer's existence. This is a terrestrial transmitter of some kind that's getting in the way. And let's see, why is it telling? There we go. And so the long wavelength radio astronomy, it's actually where radio astronomy started, when Carl Jansky discovered radio emission from the galaxy of the Milky Way. I just showed you with an image he discovered with his giant turntable antenna here, and was followed up by Grote-Reber and others. But after that initial discovery, astronomy at these frequencies kind of dried up and didn't get much interest. And so I've got my big bullet here, says, why is that? It's something I just sort of mentioned a bit ago, which is the resolution of any telescope is proportional to as goes as lambda over D, lambda being the wavelength. So as you go to really long wavelengths, if you want to get good resolution so that you can image individual objects, you have to have a very, very large aperture. So just to give you, you know, a feel for this, you know, the moon is just giving you some numbers here. The moon is half a degree, or about 1800 arc seconds. An optical telescope like Hubble that's above the atmosphere, you know, has a diameter of 2.4 meters. So the visible wavelength, you're getting a resolution of a fraction of an arc second. So sort of like 40, you know, tens of milli arc seconds. The largest steerable radio dish in the world is the Green Bank telescope. It's 100 meters across. And at 30 megahertz wavelength, even if you were using this huge dish, your resolution is 21,000 arc seconds. So in order to make an image of anything, you really need an almost impossibly large aperture. And so, you know, it's hard to do astronomy when you're almost blind, like Mr. Magoo down here. So because of that, you know, long wavelength radio astronomy was not really competitive or useful compared with other wavelength regimes. And so in general in astronomy, what was to develop to overcome this limit was to, as John alluded to earlier, was to make interferometers, to make arrays of telescopes that could be used together as one big telescope. One of the most famous sort of premier telescopes that's an interferometer in the world is the Very Large Array that's seen here in this kind of wide configuration. This is its most compact configuration. It's about a kilometer-ish in size. It's the only one where you can see all the telescopes at once and get a picture. But there are these railroad tracks here. They actually, every 4 months, they move them. And the biggest configuration is about 35 kilometers across. And so at a sort of microwave frequency, like 1400 megahertz, it's kind of GPS-ish frequency that's used a lot in radio astronomy. The largest VLA configuration can get an angular resolution about an arc second, which is competitive with, say, an optical telescope. And so you could image something at radio frequencies and compare it directly to optical and learn something about an object. And that's been sort of the premier way in which people image things at radio frequencies. But for long wavelengths, you know, the VLA was not designed to work at those frequencies and was not operating at those frequencies. And so long wavelengths were using relatively small, smaller arrays of, you can see this Clark Lake telescope here, which was a T-shaped array with these big wire mesh antennas in the 10 to 125 megahertz range, but you know, the resolution was nowhere near what you can get with the large VLA. And people weren't really building arrays like this that were much bigger than a few kilometers, and which was really hurting the resolution. And then, so the question is, well, why couldn't you make them bigger than that? And I hope you've guessed from the title of the talk that the answer is, the answer to that is the ionosphere. So as you go to any radio wave that passes through the Earth's ionosphere interacts with the free electrons that are there, and they slow that wave down. And so there's an extra sort of optical path length that's added because of that interaction, which to first order just causes some amount of refraction, but the problem is that the ionosphere is not just a smooth layer of ions. There's turbulence, there's small scale structures that occur within that. And so if you're trying to make an image of the source, we see some images here. These are sort of 1 minute cadence at 74 megahertz images. You can see these sources bopping and moving around. You can even see them becoming distorted, and you can see this one in the middle here. Every once in a while you see it kind of be kind of Y-shaped. That's the source becoming completely unfocused. And so you're getting an image of the aperture, which for the VLA is a Y-shape. And so structure in the ionosphere is making these sources move around. And it's just due to that structure that you couldn't go much farther than say 5 kilometers. Otherwise, you're larger than the correlation scale of these things in the ionosphere. And then the two antennas you're trying to correlate together won't correlate because the ionosphere is making them uncorrelated. And so this wavelength regime was kind of neglected for a very long time because the ionosphere had kind of a hard limit on what resolution you could get. But in the 80s, when the VLA was really becoming useful, there was a technique used to correct for phase variations from the troposphere or just instrumental variations called self-calibration, where you use the source you're looking at to actually calibrate. And it works because there are so many independent measurements relative to how many sensors you have that you can iterate and you can solve for gain errors at the telescope, each telescope, and then get a better model of your source and go back and forth in a loop until you've nailed down those gain errors and made a nice image of your source. Well, people thought that, well, that sounds like a solution to our ionosphere problem, because essentially the ionosphere is an extra gain term for each antenna that changes over time. It's adding a phase to each that's unique to each antenna to some degree. And so if you could use self-calibration to solve for gain errors on 1 or 2 minute timescale, you could remove this warped looking ionosphere term and make really nice high resolution images if you had a big enough telescope. And so the Naval Research Lab worked with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory to develop this 74 megahertz system on the VLA. And this is my boss here, Namir Kasim, way back when they developed this system. And it's just the system of these cross dipoles. They're actually hoisted up in by the subreflector and with rope, and they would hang them there for a few months to do this sort of dedicated observing, and using those data and applying this new self-calibration technique, for the first time we're able to get sub arc minutes, tens of or even a few arc second resolution at a 4 meter wavelength, which was a very big deal. And so you get very beautiful images of some of the brightest sources around. So there's the Cassiopeia A supernova remnant. There's this ring-like structure that's expanding outwards, the Crab Nebula, and then a couple of radio galaxies here, Virgo A and Hydra A, with these giant radio lobes. And each one of these is the brightest radio source in a constellation. It gets the name of constellation plus an A, so we call these the, even the Crab Nebula is Taurus A, so we just call these guys the A team. And this sort of revolutionized the way that you could image at these frequencies, and that's really kind of set off an almost renaissance in low frequency radio astronomy. So some of you may have heard of the low frequency array. It's called LOFAR, that was built in the Netherlands in Europe. There's another array called the Murchison Wide Field Array in Australia that's at the lower frequencies. And so being able to use these self-calibration techniques have enabled these new cutting edge telescopes to be built. But another thing that we've done at NRL is focus on the fact that because we're correcting for the ionosphere, we're also within those corrections, there's information about the structure of the ionosphere on kind of kilometer-ish scales. And that is in fact one of the reasons why the Navy is even interested in low frequency radio astronomy, is because it's a unique way of probing these kinds of structures. And so that's something I was tasked with a while back when I was hired, is that try to figure out a way to use this new calibration technique to actually study the ionosphere. And this is an example of some of that analysis, which was to take some of these measurements and try and fit some kind of wave-like model to it. And you can see these kind of wave-like structures, but then you also see structure moving down these kind of wavelengths. And this was kind of an example of the sorts of structures that kind of wreak havoc on the typical array of pre-self-calibration that was making it hard to image things at a high resolution. And so, like I said, that there's a sort of a new renaissance at these low frequencies, not just for astronomy, but also for ionospheric work. And one of the projects we're involved with is called the Long Wavelength Array, or the LWA, that is ideally supposed to consist of many of these phased array. So this is the array of the antenna I showed earlier, but it's 256 of them. And it's about 100 meters across. And so these are supposed to work like a phased array that points like a dish at a particular source. And right now there's only two of these that are about 75 kilometers apart, but they can be worked together as an interferometer. And colleagues at the University of New Mexico are slowly, you know, trying to work towards getting funding for to have many of these stations so that you could have kind of the low frequency version of the VLA, but without dishes, you'd have electronically steered arrays of antennas. And so that's the astronomy piece of it, is you need lots and lots of metal somewhere receiving these signals so that you can look at faint, interesting objects. But for the work that I've done with the VLA looking at ionospheric structure, there's a really big drawback to working with this kind of instrument, which is that, you know, astronomical sources, you can see lots of astronomical sources from a single location, but the ionosphere is different depending on where you are. And even at the same latitude, it can be different. If you're near, for instance, if you're near the mountains, atmospheric gravity waves that are generated by those mountains can get up into the ionosphere and make disturbances that you wouldn't see if you were somewhere else. And so you can't make a bunch of VLAs around the world to study the ionosphere. And so one thing that we've focused on is making something smaller that can still do the ionospheric measurements, but there could be lots of them all over the place instead of one giant array in one place. And so we've been working very recently on this concept called the deployable low band ionosphere and transient experiment called D-LIGHT. That's based on a system we have in the VLA that's called V-LIGHT. So we changed the D to make it emphasize that this thing is deployable to some extent. And so what this is, it's just it's a very, in terms of number of antennas, it's a small array. It's four antennas of these LWA type antennas, but they're spread out over a few hundred meters. And the point of that is when we're studying the ionosphere, we wanna look at one source. So we have one line of sight or multiple lines of sight to multiple sources. We don't necessarily wanna see emission from the whole sky. And so if you make the separations long enough, you can quote unquote resolve out the big extended galactic emission and just focus on the these very bright A-team sources. And then with enough bandwidth, we can separate those really bright sources from one another without having to actually make a beam and put one on each source. We can use the time of difference of arrival at the antennas to kind of separate those sources from one another. And so the handful of really bright sources, we can measure fluctuations in the ionosphere at 35 megahertz with a precision that's relatively comparable to the VLA, especially considering, you know, how much more collecting area the VLA has. And we built one of these at NRL's facility in near La Plata, Maryland. It's called Pomonkey. And initially, there were four antennas in this kind of empty front field here. And we, over time, figured out that this short baseline here, which is at not even 100 meters, was not doing as much good. So we took this antenna and we moved it over here. You can probably tell why we didn't want it here originally, because this is where all the buildings are, and not surprisingly, we get a bunch of junk here that we don't want, but this short baseline was doing us no good, so we made the decision to put the antenna over here. And so now it's about 400 meters, 350 meters from here to here, and now it's about 450 from here to here. Our friends at the University of Mexico helped us set up a second array at the site of LWA-1. It's the phased array I showed you in the previous slide. That's in this square fence here. So this is about 100 meters across. And they had a separate experiment that used these, they called them outrigger antennas. Then that experiment was no longer running. So they helped us sort of bring these back to life along with an antenna from the array. They call it lucky number 83 because it was number 83. It was actually hit by lightning. And so they weren't using it anymore. And so we put new electronics in it. And now it's resurrected and it's part of the New Mexico array. And so we have both of these arrays working, and I'll go over like a little cartoon here of how the system works. And, you know, the system was designed by a very much non-engineer. And so it all uses kind of commercial off-the-shelf, mostly parts. First with the LWA antenna. Inside this little box here is what's called an active balun. So it has some amplification, but it also does some impedance matching because, you know, we can use this for wavelengths that are bigger, much bigger than the antenna. So it's electrically short. And so there's the electronics in here help balance that out. And so they're powered over the coaxial cable through what's called a bias T. It sends just DC power over the coaxial cable. So we don't have separate power running the antennas. It's just the same coax that the signal comes down. And we're using these, some of you may be familiar with these software-defined radios by a company called Edis. These are relatively popular, not necessarily cheap, but popular software-defined radios. So each antenna gets its own radio and this nifty little rack-mounted unit, and they're all synced to the same clock because you want, in order to do the interferometry, they've all got to be on the same timing and the same oscillator. So there's a single oscillator they're all synced to in here. And there's a nice open source package called GNU Radio that can talk to the radios, and so it's pretty flexible, and you can do numerous things with it. But the nominal thing is that use it for interferometry, so we cross correlate all of these antennas. And at both sites, we're lucky enough to have an indoor enclosure that has HVAC. But you know, you can imagine putting it in one of these. These are sometimes called Hoffman boxes, and these can come with HVAC. Of varying degrees from a fan to an actual AC unit. Again, we have power at both sites, but you can imagine doing this with a generator. This doesn't draw much power. Basically, the computer draws all the power. So, you know, a few hundred watts of a computer running all the time. And, you know, the intent here was to keep this fairly cheap, fairly simple, so that it could be reproduced all over the place eventually. So this is, I just want to throw this, you're not expected to actually read through all this, but I just wanted to share, this is the GNU Radio software package, allows you to actually build up your, some of you may already be familiar with this actually, but it allows you to build up your signal processing system with the radios using these nifty little blocks, and you can just click and connect different processing blocks. So this is a huge 8-channel source that's all four radios, two polarizations per antenna, so it's 8 channels. And they're converted to vectors, and there's an FFT, and then these multiplying boxes here are what's doing the cross correlation, and we integrate for some length of time, usually about a second, and then it gets dumped to a file. And then this whole thing is interactive, but it then makes a Python file, and then you can edit the Python file however you want. And so we have, you know, a Python version of this whole flow charge that just runs every day at the start of the UT day. It starts and it records these data for almost the whole day with a little time at the end for diagnostics. And then this is what's comes out. These are what we call visibility. So this is a cross correlation between two antennas. And then typically you do that within a bunch of frequency channels and averaged over some amount of time. And these are averaged down to 1 minute And so this is a function of time for the entire day and then frequency. These are the amplitude, these are complex quantities. So we're taking complex voltages and cross-correlating them together. And you can see this is from Poe Monkey and this is from New Mexico the same day. And you can see these patterns that are in both, but they look quite different because first of all, you know, they're two different geographic locations and, but this is a north-south oriented pair of antennas and in New Mexico it's east-west. And so this interference pattern that you see in the amplitude and also the phase, the fringes here are much closer together because the baseline is longer. The longer you make the baseline, the closer together these fringe patterns will be. You also notice that there's these kind of vertically striped things. You know, this is that you don't really see in New Mexico. Those aren't supposed to be there. That's the junk that we normally have to deal with. At these frequencies, it's hard to escape, you know, bad power lines and other electronics that aren't, you know, cheap LED bulbs. They're supposed to be shielded, but aren't always can give off this kind of stuff. And also out-of-band interference can cause intermodulation that can throw interference, but it's sort of at these frequencies, it's a way of, you know, it's a part of your life. You have to deal with this stuff. But you see a very nice interference pattern here. This is from two extremely bright sources, Cassiopeia A and Cygnus A, that happen to be somewhat near each other on the sky, even though they're nowhere near each other in space. Cygnus A is its own galaxy, rather far away, and Cassiopeia is in our galaxy. And you know, one thing that we did in New Mexico, we had very good measurements of where the antennas were, and you need to know where the antennas were if you're going to do this analysis and do the interferometry. And in New Mexico, they had a very detailed site survey at some point, and they had the antennas mapped out, but at Pomaki, we didn't have that. And so we actually used the data itself. You know, we know what you can calculate what that interference pattern I just showed you should look like for a given orientation, two different antennas. And so we can actually use that kind of like a matched filter to figure out where the antennas are. And that's what these plots are showing, that we've, you know, just using my iPhone and getting what I knew was not a great GPS location. You know, we thought one of the antennas was here, but it's actually down here. And it was causing some problems with the analysis. And so by applying this, and this is what we actually do every day, not because the antennas are moving, but because we're also solving for delays along the cable, which can change over time, depending on what's happening to the cable. And so this is just a calibration thing that we do every day. But after all of that kind of processing, you know, the main thing that this is designed for is sensing the ionosphere. And that movie I showed you earlier showed that to first order, turbulence and other structures in the ionosphere will cause gradients in what we call TEC, which is the total electron content, which is the ionosphere physicist's term for column density. So column density of free electrons along the line of sight. If there are gradients in that, it will make your source look like it moves toward that gradient. And, you know, those gradients will change as structure in the ionosphere changes, and so the sources will move around, will look like they're moving around, just like that movie I showed you earlier. And so we developed this fitting process that looks at every source that's up at a given time and tries to, you know, we think we know where they are, but then the routine fits for where it looks like it is. And that offset tells us what the TEC gradient is at that time. And this is showing some plots. You know, the gradient is two-dimensional. So it is an east-west gradient and a north-south gradient. And you can probably see, so these are actually error bars on these plots. You can see that these two sources, Virgo A and Tau A, are fainter. And so the error bars are much bigger, but you can still see some structure here in the gradient, especially near Local Dawn is something like 13 UT. So there's a persistent feature from the New Mexico data where we see this kind of drop in the gradient. You can also see the error bars and some are larger in the north-south gradient because the New Mexico ray is shorter in the north-south direction. So we have less of a lever on there. But you can see from Cassiopeia A and Cygnus A, we get these very nice precise measurements. And you can see these kind of wiggles here. These are what we call traveling ionospheric disturbances. These are wave-like structures that form in the ionosphere, usually due to atmospheric disturbances that propagate upward. And they, when they hit the upper atmosphere, they lose energy and they make all kinds of secondary waves. And so it's pretty common to see those kind of wave-like disturbances, especially in New Mexico, because you know topography can drive the formation of those waves as well. And it's pretty mountainous in that part of the country. But these there's a very commonly used method that uses GPS receivers on the ground to measure this TEC property. And for those measurements, the typical error is about 0.02 tech units, which is the standard unit for TEC. And you can see, you know, even with our little four element array, we're getting pretty good precision relative to that kind of standard measurement, which we're pretty happy with. And this is just showing a one-to-one comparison looking at, here I'm calling it M87, but that's Virgo A. Some of you may know it better, but it's a Messier name, M87. We don't have control over where the VLA points, but when it does, but we do have a system on the VLA that records data at 340 megahertz. And so if someone happens to be looking at a very bright source, we can use that for ionospheric analysis as well. And someone happened to be looking at M87 in March of 2020 when we were commissioning these instruments. And so these red curves are, you know, they were looking at it kind of sporadically throughout this time period. But these are the ionospheric measurements from the VLA, which remember is this gigantic world-class telescope. And the black points are from our little array, our little D-light array. And you know, there's not a one-to-one match, but they track each other relatively well and with similar precision. So we're very happy with how that's working, that it's, you know, it's the little array that could, I guess, that's doing very well because it's optimized for ionospheric analysis, where of course the VLA is optimized for astronomy. Even though there's only four elements, you can actually still make images with this array. In fact, you can make an image with just two antennas, and that's what is being shown in this slide. So this is on the left-hand side is from Pomaki, and the right-hand side is from New Mexico. And if you integrate for long enough, in this case, about an hour or 90 minutes in case of Pomaki, you can, you know, that baseline, as the source is moving in the sky, your two antennas actually, relative to the source, sweep out a synthetic aperture that you can use to make an image. And it's actually pretty straightforward because those visibility plots I showed you before, you just take a section of that, you do a two-dimensional FFT for your transform, and you get this image. And you can pick out individual sources, Cygnus A, Cassiopeia A, Hercules A, Virgo A. But our old friend, the ionosphere, rears its head because over an hour, the ionosphere is not stable completely. And especially for these two bright sources, you can see in this direction, there are these artifacts, these very long kind of linear artifacts. And that's because especially at 35 megahertz, not only does the source look like it's moving around, it's look like it's blinking up, the intensity is going up and down as well, because the wavelength at 35 megahertz is about 8 meters. And at that wavelength, up in the ionosphere that's 300 kilometers away, the Fresnel scale is about a few kilometers. So any structure on that scale can cause intensity variations, and there's plenty of structure on those scales. So we can actually use the level of, you know, how strong these artifacts are to measure scintillation levels. And that actually tells us something about the iron sphere as well. And so we're actually using this imaging science. Is kind of fun to do and make an image of the sky with two antennas, but we're also using it for iron sphere science as well. And then just to show some fun, you know, activity that nothing to do with the iron sphere, but just a good sanity check of the system, but also something that's fun to do with, you know, this is our system, so we get to control it and we can take as much data as we want. And so using, you know, a month's worth of data, we can take those simple images I showed to make a map of the sky. And these are our A-team sources again, Cygnus and Tau and Virgo and Hercules. You can just see this little radio galaxy Hydra A popping up here on this log scale. And then down here is the same thing, but on a different stretch, just to exaggerate some things. So we don't, this line here is the galactic plane that we don't actually see very strongly, which is actually good for our purposes, because we just want to be able to look at these sources by themselves without the galactic plane kind of getting in the way. My apologies to Carl Jansky, but we don't want to look at the galactic plane in this case. And you can see Hydra A, and you can see a hint of the center of our galaxy down here, Sagittarius A. You can also see some stuff here that doesn't belong to anything, which is our old friend interference showing up in our sky map. And even though, again, I've said this array is optimized for ionospheric analysis, you can still do astronomy with us. Not as much as you can do with a much bigger array, but you can still do some fun things. One thing you can do is with this imaging analysis, we can look at the sun, not just bursts from the sun, but what it looks like over the course of a day. And so this is just an example of how you have to take great care in the fact that, so in this case, the sun was looking relatively bright at 35 megahertz, but this is the median image from all data at the same local sidereal time. And so you can see, you know, Cassiopeia A and Cygnus A, and also some galactic emission. So we want to make sure you subtract that out and get this image of the sun. And we use this to measure the brightness of the sun over a few months at 35 megahertz. And that emission is coming from way out in the corona somewhere. There's a very standard measurement of the sun's radio brightness that's called F10.7, that's at 2.8 gigahertz, and that's much closer to the surface of the sun. And in this case, you can see the two have very little to do with each other, because they're coming from two different regions. And so this was just a little interesting bit of actual astronomy that we can do. And it's actually a good proof that you can look for variable sources, transients, the T and D light. You can actually look for transient sources because we know the sun is transient and we can find it. But even beyond imaging, if we want to look at shorter time scale stuff, we can assemble what's called a bispectrum, which is to take every triangle in the array and you multiply their visibilities together. And that has a strong response to a point source and is more sensitive than if you just had four spectra from the antennas and average them together. And so this is showing this bispectrum for a solar burst that we had on the 29th, a type 2 burst that happened here, which was followed by a much longer type 4 burst. And you can also look at Jupiter bursts, and you know, normally we just run all the time at this band centered at 35 megahertz, but Jupiter bursts are actually somewhat predictable because it's caused by interactions with its moon Io, and so they're semi-predictable. And so I was able to just tune to a little bit lower frequency because they come at relatively lower frequencies, and you can see all this nice structure here over time is from a Jupiter burst. This background stuff is actually from Cassiopeia and Cygnus A. But these bursty bits are from Jupiter, and it was circularly polarized. So if you combine the two linear polarizations, you can get circular polarization. And this type of burst is known to be right circularly polarized. And so most of it is there. And bringing that up because it's a very good check that our system is stable and it works the way it's supposed to, the fact that we actually do see most of the emission in right circular polarization. So it's a very good sanity check for our little array. And so I'll just wrap up by talking about our future plan. So like I said, it's designed to go, to be able to build these things all over the place. But of course, you know, we're not exactly swimming in money. So and we don't have the personnel to build an army of D-Lite stations, but we do have some friends who are interested in this. And so we have plans, tentative plans now to build an array in New Mexico, in Texas, with some colleagues at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. They have a small array of 12 of these antennas that's covered up by this star here at a site near Port Mansfield. And so we're thinking of putting in a D-Lite array here, and then you can have it, and they have what they call an outrigger here. And so you can have actually another triangle inside the triangle with their outrigger and their 12 element array. So this would be very interesting if we pull this off. And in general, you know, well, the way we're approaching this is, in addition to the science that we like to do with this, it's actually a very good learning instrument. And so we're trying to encourage all of our partners at universities to look into this and see if they are interested in it, because it's a good way to just learn interferometry and a good way for students to learn. And, you know, even though, you know, we have our own limited resources, we're still certainly available to help anybody stand up their own station. And it's another reason why we've tried to keep the cost, you know, in the tens of thousands and not hundreds of thousands ballpark, because not only do we want to be able to build our own at some point around the world, but, you know, we like to encourage anybody who's interested to build these things, you know, starting small, but hopefully expanding outward. And so I just want to, you know, leave you with, you know, the big emphasis here is on the ionosphere, but you know, there are other things you can do with this system. I gave you an example of looking at, you know, solar system astronomy, so the sun and Jupiter. There's also just monitoring the brightness of Cassiopeia A is interesting, because as it expands, it's actually known to be fading over time. And so having a dedicated system that just pounds away at measuring the intensity of Cass A is something interesting. There's other cool things you can do, like this is something I've done where some of you may know the WWV radio station that sends out the time at HF frequencies. The Canadians have a station as well. We can get both of those at Pomonkey with our Hooray. And so these are pulses that come every second. WWVs are very short and CHUs are long and sort of short. But you can do fun stuff with that, and you can actually do ionospheric science with that, because you can watch the Doppler shift of these things move around as the ionosphere is changing. And then just an example of science that you don't know is going to happen until you look. This is at a different frequency, but there was a student project using a few small dish antennas that found a vast radio burst, which is very cool. And it shows that, you know, you don't necessarily need giant radio telescopes to do interesting science. So I'll wrap it up there.
Thank you. If anyone has questions, feel free to use the raise hand function so that we can see who has a question, and we'll call on folks. Go ahead, Harold, unmute yourself.
Oh, you're muted still.
Harold, unmute yourself.
Have you ever used Arecibo before or after it got damaged?
No, I have not. There are some folks at NRL who did, who worked on pulsars, is mainly what they had used it for. And actually, there are ionospheric scientists at NRL who used it. There's something called a heater, which doesn't really heat anything, but they pump radio waves in the ionosphere and you can actually make an artificial ion layer. And so it's a tremendous loss, that facility. So everyone's scrambling to come up with plans to put something else there.
Any other
questions? I understand originally they used chicken wire before they had a real mesh. Is the chicken wire, can that work on your wavelengths or not?
One of the things we do is underneath our antennas, we put what is essentially chicken wire or welded wire as a ground screen, because, you know, the wavelengths are so long that you can use something as porous as chicken wire and it still works. And so that mitigates a little bit of the interference, because we're not getting reflections off the ground right into the antenna.
Any other questions? Come on, don't be shy. Be sure.
Just a comment. I'm really impressed by the way you and your team are being innovative about things.
Thank you.
Making the best use of what's available and figuring out things that people didn't think about using.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had one question also. We were always told that Green Bank was a good place to do radio astronomy because there are no radio stations near there. And you have a site in La Plata, Maryland, which is inundated by radio stations from the metropolitan Washington area. Why was La Plata, Maryland chosen?
For convenience more than anything. It was so that we would have a site that we could go to without having to spend all day getting there. So it's, you know, it's a reasonable driving distance from our main NRL facility in DC. So it's just sort of a prototype that we could go check on. And we've had to change a few things. Like, for instance, the really long runs of cable we have are susceptible to currents that are induced by lightning. And so they've fried a few of our electronics. So then we have to go down there and change it out. And we've tried a few things. The other thing is the radio stations actually are not much of a problem. But we had an issue with, there are still some TV stations that broadcast in the VHF bands, like 54 megahertz to 60 megahertz, I think is the lowest one, in Delaware. And there are planes that fly over Pomunkey all the time going to BWI or back. And we actually get reflections off the planes down to our antennas. And so we had to put filters in that cut off at 50 megahertz, because we're just working at 35 megahertz anyway. So there's not really supposed to be anybody transmitting in that band, but of course there's stuff there. But yeah, definitely a quieter site would be better. And the New Mexico site is actually relatively quiet, except every once in a while they have issue with a power line and then everything is kind of trash. So even though, you know, Green Bank is a radio quiet zone, that doesn't mean there might not be a bad, you know, power pole somewhere that needs the ground wire replaced or something. Because they don't, Green Bank itself doesn't go below, I think, 300 megahertz. So it's a uniquely troublesome band that we specialize in.
Well, was the La Plata site there more than 20 years ago?
I don't know how long it's been there. It's been there, it predates me by quite a bit.
Because about 20 years ago, there was a major tornado that went right through La Plata.
This is out kind of in the boondocks. It's not so bad because it is kind of in the middle of nowhere. And I'm not entirely sure what the interference we're getting is from. Actually, the guys in New Mexico devised this really cool system where they have one of their antennas in the back of a pickup, and they have a data recorder in the back in the cab, and they would drive around the VLA site and they would take spectra at different locations because they would know, roughly speaking, there's a bad power pole that way, but they didn't know which one it was. And so now they have a little truck where they drive around. And I kind of want to do that at PoMonkey because I want to figure out which one is giving me all the problems.
Well, there are some relatively quiet public park sites not too far from La Plata. I think Calvert Cliffs is not too far.
Yeah. Well,
but that's got a nuclear reactor.
Well, also, I mean, you can't beat the convenience of land that your organization already owns. I found that out the hard way. We're working on another array in Florida, which is on Air Force property, and it's remarkably difficult. Well, it's not difficult, but it's a lot of, you know, jumping through hoops and paperwork to set up there, even though it's within the Department of Defense family. It's easier to just go to your, you know, fellow NRLers and build another array on land we already own.
Are there any further questions? If not, let's thank our speaker again for a very good talk.
I have a quick question. How much of a loss was our seabar to radio astronomy?
What?
I'm sorry?
How much of a loss was our seabar to radio astronomy?
A pretty big loss. The next biggest, I mean, the Green Bank telescope is also a very big aperture, but it's almost an order of magnitude less collecting area. So there's just nothing else. Well, the Chinese have a very large telescope now, but there's really nothing else that had that kind of sensitivity.
Did you have you run into anything that really throws you for a loop, some sort of signal, some major thing from outside?
There was something at the PoMonkey site in particular, that sometimes it would turn on at a weird time, like 1 p.m. or something, and then go on into the night and then stop. And with the array, you can get a little bit of an idea where it's coming from. And maybe it was from somebody's house, but, you know, we can't just walk up someone's driveway, and especially in the middle of nowhere. Say, hey, do you have a porch light that's got a weird bulb in it? It is such a weird time, too. It's not like, you know, a dusk to dawn light that turns on at dark. It was in the middle of the afternoon. But then it went away. So I have no idea what it was or if it'll be back. But yeah, some of the human-made stuff is confusing. I don't know where it's coming from. Especially when, you know, if you look at the FCC chart, that the band we work in doesn't have much allocated to it.
Okay, let's give him a hand again. Thank you very much, Joe. And I guess if there's no further questions and no further announcements, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out, and we'll see you next month. Make sure you save those emails, and we'll talk to y'all next month.
And thank you, Joe, a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Well, see you next time.
Bye-bye. How are you doing, Todd?
Okay, my phone just rang. Oh, it's probably my dad. I'll be back within a second.
All right. Hello. Yeah. Jeff, Michael, go ahead and leave the meeting. I'm going to talk with Todd about some stuff.
Yeah, I'll bring it over tomorrow. I found one. I looked.